Local news, culture, and NPR.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the local edition on a Wednesday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Roballo, filling in for Jason Dole for the rest of the week. We have a packed show for you tonight, so let's get straight to it. In the second half of the show, we'll learn about the National Endowment for the Arts, how it has pulled its grants from local theater companies. We'll hear from Farm Arts Artistic Director Tanis Kowalczuk and NACL's Brett Kaiser about what the loss of the NEL funding really means and why the arts matter now more than ever. Before that, we'll talk to Ruby Rayner from The River Reporter to find out what's happening in Sullivan County and Northeast Pennsylvania. But before that, on Sunday, President Donald Trump announced that he had authorized imposing a 100% tariff on all foreign films. Filmmakers and local film commissions in New York say it's a bad idea and it's not feasible. WAMC's North Country Bureau Chief Pat Bradley reports.
The president says the movie industry in the U.S. is dying. He claims other countries are offering incentives that are, quote, propaganda and a, quote, concerted effort that is therefore a national security threat. He directed that a 100% tariff be imposed on all movies, quote, produced in foreign lands, unquote. Kingdom County Productions co-founder Jay Craven says the tariff would have a chilling effect on all filmmakers.
It will restrict the flow of films from other countries to this country. It will also put a penalty on filmmakers who want to shoot American films outside the United States. It will certainly result in fewer films getting made. It also is likely to trigger a retaliation for American films, including films by independent filmmakers, being able to access foreign markets, especially coupled with the recent cutbacks to the National Endowment for the Arts. It's really a turbulent time for the arts in general right now. Film in particular is such a precarious enterprise. What it takes to get a film made, cobbling the money together, trying to get it released, all of this is so difficult if you're working independently and outside the mainstream that this will only have a crimping effect.
Albany County Film Commissioner Debbie Gedeke says a tariff results in negative results regardless of the sector. As far as the film industry, she says new incentives should be created to make the U.S. competitive with other countries.
Look what they're giving away. It's a little bit less expensive to film. I think they give greater tax incentives. So all of that adds up to a film production. Anything that can cut their costs, especially now, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, they weren't so worried about location fees. But now, with the economy and everything the way it is, they're taking notice of any single thing that they can do to cut costs.
Mr. Scout, I know you're still weighing whether to return to Lumen. But the mark I've come to know is happy.
Hello, is anyone there? Is the board on? It's Marquez from Macrot.
With the popular Apple TV series Severance just one example, Gedeke notes that New York State has been successful in luring filmmakers by offering tax credits.
We had a banner year last year here in Albany with film productions, and a lot had to do with the film tax credits and the incentives that are available. And they came and shot in upstate New York. We had Paramount Pictures, HBO, and Hallmark, and they contributed significantly to the economy. So I think we have to look at ways to keep incentives here in the United States to keep people working, to add that economic impact to our communities. That's what I think we need to look at.
In addition to promoting the Adirondacks as a venue and assisting regional filmmakers, Adirondack Film shows a number of foreign films during its Lake Placid Film Festival and monthly series. Chair Gary Smith says the idea of a tariff is somewhat alarming and is curious how the value of a foreign film will be determined for a tariff.
30% of our films that we show at the festival historically have been foreign films. one of the ones that technically was a foreign film that was showed last year was made in Germany, but it was about Nathan Farb. So that makes me wonder, is that a foreign film about a U.S. subject, or is it a U.S. film made by a German filmmaker? What are you really dealing with, and how do you place value on it, and how do you put 100% tariff on it?
President Trump authorized the Department of Commerce and Office of the U.S. Trade Representative to impose the tariff. The Associated Press reports that the White House said it was figuring out how to comply. In Plattsburgh, I'm Pat Bradley for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you to Pat Bradley for that, and thank you to the New York Public News Network. Let's move right along to some more local news. On the phone with us now is Ruby Rayner from the River Reporter. Ruby, welcome back to the program. One of the stories that we've been following for the past couple of days and weeks is Sullivan County's Human Rights Commission. They recently hired a full-time executive director, Ramon Wilson. But there been a lot of controversy about some of the appointments of the Human Rights Commission. Do you want us to just talk about some of these controversy over the appointments? Who has been appointed and what is the controversy around it?
Yeah, sure. So the Sullivan County Human Rights Commission, which, as you mentioned, the newly hired executive director, Ramon E. Wilson, it's made up of two arms. It's this 9-person board of residents that are appointed by the county legislators, and then this executive director. And their goal is to be public advocates and to protect human rights in the county by aiding people in different filings of potential human rights complaints, offering education about those different human rights areas like housing or discrimination in the workplace, discrimination in general, and stuff like that. So that's what these people do and why we're talking about these appointments, is because the legislature voted to approve a new set of people to serve on this Human Rights Commission with this new director. And two of those appointments brought a lot of controversy. So one of them was the appointment of Amanda Ward, who is a legislator herself. So a peer of hers, legislator Brian McPhillips, appointed her. She's done a lot of work to get this Human Rights Commission back up and running. Controversy is not new for the Human Rights Commission. It's had a bit of a rocky recent history. The commission has fallen defunct twice previously. It disbanded in 2019 because of resignations, and then again in 2023 when the then executive director resigned very publicly, citing a lack of support and recognition. So the real core of the issues over Amanda Ward, the legislator's appointment, was a lot of people at public comment at the legislature speaking about this felt that there was the potential to introduce a conflict if a legislator was serving as a human rights commissioner, as well as in their capacity as a legislator. Former members of the Human Rights Commission, who served as the chair, Judy Balaban, for many years until 2019, as well as other former members, talked about how they would get complaints from county employees about potential human rights violations. And so that introduces a potential conflict when one of the commissioners is also somebody who represents, you know, the county as a legislator and votes on different various other things, and how that could potentially pose a conflicting issues and having them have to recuse themselves, and that they didn't want these people who were speaking about her appointment didn't want there to be that conflict of interest, and really wanted the sanctity of the Human Rights Commission to have the members just have the interest of advocating for county residents' human rights and not have anything else that was predicated on potentially their position as, say, a legislator in this case, is what they were talking about. So that's the main kind of controversy over the appointment of Amanda Ward to the Human Rights Commission.
Right. And there was another controversial appointment, which was Bill Liblick, he's the Facebook group moderator of Sullivan County Post. He was appointed by legislature Luis Alvarez. And at least let's talk about why his was controversial, his appointment.
Yeah, so that was the other appointment that brought up a kind of a lot of discussion by residents who spoke against urging legislators to not approve his appointment. So he served on the commission in the past. So he served on the former Human Rights Commission from 2016 to 2019. And as you said, he moderates like a very popular Facebook group, which has a lot of different community county posts and happenings and opinions. Luis Alvarez appointed him and he said that he appointed him because he has really close ties and good relationships with different law enforcement in the county and would be able to bring those relationships to benefit the Human Rights Commission and really felt that he would do a good job. So that's why Louis said that he picked Bill Liblick. But some of the people who were really concerned about that appointment talked about a lot of the inflammatory language that they said was used on these two different Facebook groups, Sullivan County Post and Sullivan County Uncensored, that Bill Liblick moderates. And in addition to just bringing up the fact that those groups are oftentimes, as they said, quote, these public residents, divisive, another resident brought up a 2012 opinion post that Bill Liblick had posted about Spanish language requirements for ballots at the time. So this was in 2012, but in this piece, he wrote, quote, "The biggest, latest waste of Sullivan County tax dollars is a new federal mandate requiring ballots in certain election districts to be printed in Spanish," end quote. And the then opinion post ends with this quote that I'll read. He said, Bill Liblick said, quote, "If the federal government wants us to enforce such a ridiculous mandate, they should reimburse us for the cost of printing the extra ballots, programming voter machines, and hiring an interpreter. If someone cannot read or write English, perhaps they just shouldn't vote," end quote. And Ms. Hernandez, who was talking about how this really was upsetting and a reason for him to not be on the Human Rights Commission, she said at the legislature, "Such inflammatory thinking undermines the exact efforts of the Human Rights Commission to enforce and prohibit discrimination." And his statement really, she said, disqualifies him as someone who should be able to serve on the Human Rights Commission. If they're publicly expressing this kind of what she said, quote, "prejudicial, limited, and yes, racist opinion," end quote, that they can't really be the right person to protect fellow citizens. So that was the main controversy around that appointment. But both Amanda Ward as a legislator and Bill Liblick were approved and they are by the legislators' votes and they are on the commission.
Right. And I think it's important I point out, according to the new executive director of the Human Rights Commission and the county's communications director, the commission, from what I understand, is not going to have any sort of direct contact with cases, but really is more of an outreach commission as far as outreaching and to the community, attending events and things like that. So is that how you understand it also?
Yes. Yeah, so the Human Rights Commission doesn't have any investigative authority. So anything that needs to be investigated or rises to that level would be sent up to the state. That's correct. But how the Human Rights Commission has operated is that people a lot of times don't know, is this a violation of my human rights? What should I do? Where should I go? And so the point is that they come to these different members of the board and they come to the Human Rights Commission director and they say, hey, this is what I'm dealing with. And so I think the issue that was brought up is that these are supposed to be the representatives of that kind of liaisoning, connecting people with different services and helping them navigate what educational materials they might need if this is something that needs to be reported to the state Human Rights Commission to investigate. So that they would be the people to, when you think about it, they're representing the commission. So they would be the people to do that. So I think that's where some former members and residents were bringing up that it's important that there isn't potentially a conflict or that these people, in their opinion, embody the values of what the mission of the Human Rights Commission is.
One thing is good that the Sullivan County has now a full-time executive director for the Sullivan County Human Rights Commission. As you said, the former director and many times said it over that it was a full-time position. So now Selma Kathy has one, which is good, I think.
Yeah, that was a big push that came out of the past executive director, Adrian Jensen, which was a part-time position, resigning in front of the legislature and saying, this body needs more support from the county. It's a big job. There's a lot of people in the county who have concerns and need the services that the Human Rights Commission provides. And so now there is a full-time human rights executive director, and they're going to, Ramon hopefully, and has talked about really wanting to make strides and connect with different groups and folks in the community and work with proactive solutions to human rights concerns so that anything could be prevented.
Yeah. Let's move across the river to Honesdale. They're implementing a new parking app and parking violation enforcement, which is something I've seen a lot of. If you go to New York City, now you could, instead of putting money into the machine to get your ticket to pay for parking, you could do it through an app. So it looks like that's what Honesdale is doing, right?
Yes. So Honesdale is implementing what's called the Pango mobile app for parking payments. You can still use the traditional coin-operated meters that are there right now, and that will remain as an alternative option. But there then will also be this app in which users can register their license plate, select the zone, and then pay with their phone for that parking. And so that's being introduced. And that app, like you said, there's a couple of other, you've seen that ability. This particular app is also used already in Pennsylvania and in Scarsdale, New York, and Virginia, and a couple of other places. So this isn't the first place that Pango will be used. And then in addition to that parking app, there's also some other parking related updates in Honesdale. Burr was deploying what they call safety sticks, which are these automated enforcement cameras. So they're these little 3-foot poles with cameras intended to monitor illegal parking spots from the company Municipal Parking Services. And so what they've said is that they really don't have the means to enforce and ticket for illegal parking. And so these cameras that are going to be implemented, and right now there's plans of deploying 20 to 25 of them, will then take a photo of the license plate after detecting a violation. And then that list gets automatically sent to that company, MPS, Municipal Parking Services, who then review it and send it back to the borough for approval. And then they'll issue those parking violation tickets.
Now, what was the reason for the upgrade in technology? Was there a parking issue in Honesdale?
What the borough councilors discussed was that they don't have the capacity to, like the employees or people to walk around to assess whether there's parking violations and then ticket people and then process those tickets. And people say that they see and that they know that there's these parking violations happening, but that there's no kind of enforcement arm to deal with them quickly and accurately and timely because of just not enough resources. So this was the alternate solution to be able to enforce that using these new cameras and service.
Now, you mentioned about the cameras, which always brings up the talk of Big Brother watching. Had this been sort of any pushback or concerns about the cameras now being installed?
Yeah, so one of the council members, Jim Hamill, expressed concerns about just exactly what you're saying over like increased surveillance. He referenced the show Black Mirror, which is like a sci-fi kind of show that talks about, in the show, it depicts like technology and oversight and stuff like that, and compared it. And that there was other officials who are council members who are in favor of it, and they really stress that these aren't surveillance tools. They can only capture the license plates. And Mayor of Honesdale, Derek Williams, reiterated that these will only be capturing license plates, and they're not cameras that are being used to survey. So that was the discussion around that.
Ruby, that's all the time we have for now. Thank you so much for talking to us. We're talking to Ruby Rayner, the reporter for The River Reporter, who we talk to every Wednesday to let us know what's happening in Sullivan County and also Northeast Pennsylvania. Ruby, until next week, thank you so much. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back and we'll learn how funding has been cut from the arts here locally. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
I think Buffett ultimately made the world a little smarter about how the system really works. And I think by the public understanding how the system really works, you like to think that improves the system because there are fewer people to cheat.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Welcome back to The Local Edition on a Wednesday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. Earlier today on Radio Catskill, Mr. Bruno spoke about the National Endowment for the Arts. This weekend, an unexpected email from the National Endowment for the Arts landed like a bang at two local theater companies, Farm Arts Collective in Damascus, Pennsylvania, and NACL in Highland Lake, New York. Farm Arts was informed that its $10,000 federal arts grant, already awarded and in use for the 2025 production, was being withdrawn. NACL lost a $20,000 grant. No explanation, no warning. These funding losses threaten not only these local groups, but also the local culture and economic ecosystem that has grown up around them. This morning on Radio Catskill, Tim Bruno spoke to Tanis Kowalczuk, founding artist director of Farmers Collective, and Brett Kaiser, director of engagement at NACL, about the broader implications of this decision, from the fate of a rural arts organization to the value of a nation places on its creative voices.
So I want to ask you, Tanis, and also Brett, what did this mean to you guys when you first heard this?
Well, for Farm Arts Collective, the money from the NEA was going towards an artistic project called Dream on the Farm. And we had begun the project in the winter, and receiving that information on a Saturday morning, which was a very bizarre time to receive it, I have to say, just really shocked me, because we had been promised. We had, you know, had done the paperwork and had started the project already and had included it in our budget, and that money was one third of our budget for this project.
$10,000, is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
And Brett, what about NACL?
It was, of course, alarming. I can't say that it wasn't fully unexpected, given the course that things have been taking recently. You know, nevertheless, we all find ourselves in the same boat, including Radio Catskill, you know, from different sources. But the way that small companies manage themselves is very hand to mouth. And so if, you know, you work with what you have, and if you have a grant that's there, then suddenly you can say, okay, we're going to do these things. And then suddenly when you can't, it's not like free money. The money has already been put into play.
Yeah. And you guys are both embedded in the local ecosystem here, your theater companies, but you also support the local economy as well. How does this ripple through for not just your productions, but just the overall ecosystem for the area and arts in general?
Well, I if you think of it as a food chain, you know, we are part of the whole ecosystem, as you say, and to be able to suddenly not have enough money to do a project and to perhaps have to potentially cancel a project, it's just, you know, people A, are not getting paid what they ought to be paid for their work as artists, and that ripples out into what they're spending in the economy. But also, if you're reducing your programming, people aren't going to the coffee shops, people aren't going to the restaurants, they're not going to the gas stations. It just like has this like kind of freeze, this ice age freeze on our lifestyles, our life here. And it's really, really alarming.
Tanis, you brought along what the NEA said they would accept for funding arts organizations. Can you read from some of the NEA's proposals for obtaining funding now in this new era?
Right. So we've been asked to change our focus with our artwork. And that we've also been asked as artists to make an appeal. And many advocacy groups have told us that we ought to be writing our appeal letter. So I did that. I sent it in on Monday, along with, I know, many, many other organizations who had been cut. But what they're saying is that the artistic heritage and creativity is prioritized by the president. Consequently, we are terminating awards that fall outside new priorities, which include Elevate the Nation's ABCUs, HBCUs, and Hispanic-serving institutions, celebrate the 250th anniversary of American independence, foster AI competency, empower houses of worship to serve communities, assist with disaster recovery, foster skilled trade jobs, make America healthy again, support the military and veterans, support tribal communities, make the District of Columbia safe and beautiful, and support economic development of Asian American communities. This does not seem like an arts mandate to me.
It seems like it's a list of some other priorities of this administration put into one other letter. Brett, what was your reaction?
Well, I mean, as you say, and as anybody who listens to the list there, it's not a real list. And what one maybe can glean from this is that they're not intending on funding anything. They have to put this out there as a sort of screen that says, oh, well, we'll fund these things if they happen to come our way. But I just read an article yesterday that said that there was a Hispanic arts organization that serves the community, I believe it was in Chicago, and their grant was terminated as well. So even what is right there stated in the thing is not true. It's not happening.
What is it that you guys can do? What are the next steps in addressing this funding shortfall, Tanis?
Well, as I mentioned, they recommend that we make the appeal and just put our name.
Are you going to do that?
Yeah, I did it on Monday. Yeah.
Okay.
The advocacy groups like Americans for the Arts, which is a great advocacy group, suggested it. And it's just marking your resistance, just putting yourself in the line of resistance. And I know for us, we're just going to try to make it up by going to our community. And it's already been really they've been very generous. A lot of people. Yeah, I mean, it's always the same answer. You know, it's like the problem here is also the U.S. is the lowest, one of the lowest of the G7 countries in their appropriation towards the arts. So it's like, for example, in 2024, the U.S. granted $5.44 per American for the arts, for their experiencing the arts in the country. In Canada, that same year, the distribution was $124 per person. So it's just like we always have to go to other means. It's true. You know, we always have to find other ways of supporting us. But this is more of a... This is a sign. This is a canary in the coal mine of a cultural revolution that's coming from the government.
Brett, are you at an ACL also appealing, and what are your next steps?
We have appealed, and as many people know, we operate out of a former Franciscan Catholic church, and our appeal letter stated that we are.
To qualify for that house of worship thing,
we appealed under the house of worship clause, with no disrespect to any other houses of worship, but we are spiritually uplifting our community through the upliftment of the arts, and artists are creating work today.
We're gonna wrap up this part of things here because we actually have guests from NACL's next production coming up this weekend. We want to make sure we talk about that so folks can learn more about what the great work that's coming up this weekend. But also, if folks are listening and want to support or learn more, where can they reach out to you both?
We have a website where people could make a donation. That's www.farmartscollective.org, or email me, Tanis@farmartscollective.org.
Right. Same thing for NACL. It's NACL.org. And I just want to remind everybody that Radio Catskill is also in need as part of this ecosystem.
Thank you so much to Tim Bruno for that interview. Again, I've been your host, Patricio Roballo, for this Wednesday evening on The Local Edition. Lucy, have a good night. Everyone else,